Welcome to Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, where we explore how studies here are changing our world today and in the future. I'm John Worsey, a writer at the University of Portsmouth. This time, we take a look at seaside towns, often portrayed in books and films as being a unique combination of pleasure and danger. The modern-day coastal town carries a lot of its past alongside the challenges of the current day. Dr. Tom Sykes is Associate Professor of Creative Writing and Social Journalism.
Louis and I really became optimists by the end of this because we saw a lot of the poverty and a lot of the kind of social problems facing seaside towns were being kind of combated by people working together in very constructive and creative ways to deal with these problems.
And Dr. Louis Netter is Senior Lecturer in Illustration at the University of Portsmouth.
Because of the relative cheapness of holidays abroad and so forth, the English seaside is less of a destination than it used to. But that doesn't mean that these seaside towns have given up.
Tom and Louis have collaborated to produce a book called Coast of Teeth, which is described as a gonzo tour of seaside towns in the anxious, absurd age of COVID, Brexit, climate crisis, and harrowingly bad karaoke. But we'll look beyond the UK's beaches and discover some surprising facts about coastal communities around the world. Whether it's seaside towns in the UK, like Brighton or Blackpool, or the Atlantic City of the Boardwalk Empire TV show, why is the seaside town so much a part of popular imagination?
There are lots of reasons, but I think one that really interested us is this sort of notion of the seaside town as a kind of liminal space, as a kind of place that is between conditions, between situations, not only physically in terms of being on that sort of border between the land and the sea, but also conceptually as well, in the sense that there are these strange contradictions and these strange kind of mixtures of moods and attitudes. Seaside towns are, on the one hand, especially out of season, can be quite sort of miserable places where there isn't much going on. Seaside towns have been on the business end of kind of economic decline. So there's the sort of dark aspects of seaside towns, but then there's the more positive, lighter side of seaside towns, which is very much to do with hedonism and enjoyment and people escaping the daily grind of their jobs in order to go and have a good time and drink too much, eat too much, do things that they wouldn't normally do at home. Within that, in terms of the sort of amusements and distractions that are available to people in seaside towns, you have these sort of intriguing, a lot of these are quite sort of representative of something bigger, something conceptually larger that a writer and an artist will be naturally attracted to.
Tom grew up on Hayling Island on the Hampshire coast and just a short distance from the University of Portsmouth. He had an early fascination with seaside amusements, especially one machine that he feels almost represents the coastline.
People put coins into a machine and you have these moving cliffs. The hope is that you'll keep putting money in and the coins will start dripping out and then fall into the bit where you can get 2p's or 10p's out. What's interesting about that is that there's something represent, you know, just as you have natural cliffs of rock on in England's seaside, so you have these kind of machines that seem to emulate that. But there's also, we saw other games of chance and other forms of gambling that people get up to in seaside towns is reflective of a certain kind of aspiration that a lot of that we encountered amongst people that we met in seaside towns. In other words, someone is living in a seaside town, not terribly happy with their lives, not exactly living their best life, as it were, but they hope that maybe, just maybe, they'll win their way out of there. What is your ticket out of that kind of situation? These sorts of amusements and these sorts of games seem to reflect that kind of lottery winner sort of mentality that we came across quite a bit in the course of our travels.
It's an interesting mix of sort of fun and frivolity and sort of desperation that you sort of see in the contemporary seaside town. This is also true in places I've been to in the States as well. That sense of people going there, having a good time and leaving, but there are other people that can't necessarily leave, that are somewhat economically stranded in the seaside town. And that sort of speaks to how these seaside towns really have also been victims of government neglect and funding, and also that essentially, really, you're looking at a boom and bust sort of economy. And the dead season is long and cold and wet. And it's not fun to eat an ice cream or fish and chips in the cold, dark rain. So those places are not going to kind of thrive.
Louis thinks there's a certain stoicism needed for the English seaside town as well.
The kind of defiance of the weather is a real part of the English seaside. Doing the best you can under this kind of circumstances with pebbly beaches, North Sea, wind and rain, which we experienced when we were in Clacton-on-Sea. So it's desperately trying through amusements, through these piers, through all these various recreation facilities, trying to make it this great and exciting place. And I think part of the interesting identity of the English seaside is that sometimes that can be a struggle for a variety of reasons. And I think because of the relative cheapness of holidays abroad and so forth, the English seaside is less of a destination than it used to. But that doesn't mean that these seaside towns have given up. Many of them are certainly still trying to attract people. And because of their sort of unique geography and unique space in our culture, they still sort of maintain a certain kind of cachet of value.
Staying firmly in the world of British fish and chips and ice cream for now, for an artist like Louis, the visual images from the seaside towns of the early 20th century hold historical interest.
Somebody like Donald McGill, who's famous for the sort of cheeky postcards at a time when the English seaside was heavily frequented by people across the country. These postcards were really sort of hitting a kind of humorous note amongst people of that particular era. Of course, they're fairly misogynistic, crude, and not terribly politically correct, but that also does reflect the sort of time and place. But photographers like Tony Ray Jones and Martin Parr are probably better known chroniclers of the seaside town. Tony Ray Jones being slightly more sort of sentimental, and then Martin Parr, who's come under some scrutiny for his depiction of sort of working class seaside goers, sunburned and exhausted, something almost a little bit spent about the sort of people that Martin Parr has depicted. The term today might be punching down, perhaps, and that might be the way that he's perceived.
Let's head out to sea and over to the United States, where Tom can make comparisons with American seaside towns.
I'm a kind of boardwalk empire nut. But what is striking, I think, about those depictions, and again, it's about contradictions and about paradoxes, because boardwalk empire is about organized crime, and it's about how there's a kind of a Faustian pact between, if you want these pleasurable things, these commodities and these experiences that sort of capitalism has to offer, whether it's kind of bootlegged booze or dancing to jazz music or smoking or whatever your poison is, there's always a dark underbelly to that. The provision of that enjoyment and fun has to come at the cost of the appalling mobster maneuvers that have to be made. You see the same kind of dynamic in Graham Greene's Brighton Rock, classic novel of organized crime in Brighton in the sort of 1930s. There are scenes in fairgrounds, and there are scenes of people eating their rock candy and their ice creams and having a good time, and a sort of love affair plays out. But it's all at the cost of the exploitation and the violence.
I was just reminded, actually, when Tom was talking about that really incredible episode of The Sopranos, where Tony Soprano is having a sort of fever dream, and he's walking along what looks to be something like Atlantic City Boardwalk, actually. And it's interesting, too, that kind of carnivalesque and the dark tones and textures of a kind of seaside place. It's interesting how that can be easily sort of twisted. I think also how the kind of the furniture of the pier and sort of laughing faces and jokers and the haunted ride or something like that, all of that can turn quite phantasmagorical pretty quickly and turn sort of almost hallucinogenic kind of qualities about that. And I think there was a Dennis Hopper film, Night Tide, I think it was called, in the sort of 50s. And that takes place on the Santa Monica Pier. And very similarly, it's using the pier and the sort of furniture around the pier and fortune teller, all that sort of stuff, to create a kind of mood and atmosphere of menace and also a dreamlike atmosphere as well.
If you've not visited many seaside towns, we might be giving you a bad impression. there's lots to be positive about as well. Something that Tom and Louis got to see on their travels.
The efforts of people in their sort of local communities to do things for themselves and make the best of the sort of difficult conditions that we've already talked about, whether it's small community art kind of projects responding creatively to the sort of challenges of rising sea levels and flooding, which we saw in places like Clacton-on-Sea and Jaywick, that sort of area, or somewhere like Blackpool, which has a very thriving sort of LGBTQ plus scene within what is traditionally quite a working class, old-fashioned, perhaps certain points in time, more kind of conservative sort of town or mentality.
And a coastline can often mean a more diverse community.
I myself have very deep roots in what was once one of the largest Jewish communities of any city in Britain. We've had 6 or 7 Jewish mayors of Portsmouth over the last couple of hundred years, which is a record compared to even, you know, other cities like Leeds and Manchester and obviously London that have large Jewish communities. There's also claimed that the first major Polish community in Britain was in Portsmouth because these were Polish sailors who were exiled abroad because they were plotting to overthrow the then Russian Tsar. And if you look back, as I have done, at some of the original newspaper reporting, these people were welcomed with open arms by people in Portsmouth, and there was a whip around for to get them clothes and food and the things that they needed after this epic voyage from sort of Eastern Europe to here. And there was a welcoming kind of vibe when they got to Portsmouth, and you think, well, that's perhaps in contrast to some of the less welcoming attitudes that some people have today towards immigrants and towards refugees and asylum seekers. So, yes, we can learn from history, I think, in that way. And we can learn from the history of seaside towns how to be perhaps a bit more tolerant and a bit more open-minded in the way that we behave today, perhaps.
If you're enjoying Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, then you might like one of our other episodes. Now in our 13th series, there is a wealth of stories to be explored and information to be understood over more than 100 episodes. If you've been inspired by the stories of the Portsmouth coastline, then you might like to head out over the waves in the company of Dr. Anne Coates. She's been leading a cutting-edge project to investigate shipwrecks alongside the UK coast.
While I was doing my project, I realised that Portsmouth Dockyard was key to everything in Portsmouth. It had made Portsmouth, you know, a borough as opposed to a little fishing town. And the reason why it was so suitable for a dockyard is its geography, its geology, its position on the south coast, it's even its climate.
That episode, alongside all the others, is available to stream for free, wherever you listen to your podcasts. So far on our exploration of seaside towns, we've focused quite a lot on the UK. But it might surprise you that the British seaside town is something we've exported around the world.
The prototype for the seaside towns that you see in North America, for example, and I think also parts of Australia, was really the kind of British Victorian seaside town. So really just in a very short period of time, really the 1870s and 1880s, all the quintessential facets of the seaside as we think of it today start to appear in places like Scarborough and Blackpool and Brighton in the south and so forth, whether it's donkey rides, people making sand castles, fish and chips, promenade walkways along next to the seaside. There's a second wave in the 1930s, I think, where things like flip-flops appear, partly because plastics and rubber is being sourced from other countries. These are not necessarily resources that are available within the UK or within parts of North America and so forth. So yeah, because of the nature of sort of global capitalism, you know, the seaside town does start to kind of be imitated and mimicked outside of the UK.
And over time, cultural twists on the original Victorian seaside town were imported back to the UK.
There's a lot of exotic imagery that you will find even today in amusement arcades. It's very hard to find an amusement arcade in a seaside town in England that doesn't reference kind of ancient Egypt. These are obviously very kind of crude, sort of quite stereotypical, almost kind of orientalist images. We need to bear that caveat in mind, but also various kinds of Americana, the sort of Wild West swinging doors, reminiscent of cowboy movies or something. You've got these funny sort of simulacra or simulations of landmarks and structures from abroad. There's a Venetian bridge in Torquay, I believe, which looks like a bridge in Venice. So yeah, the seaside towns in England also bear the hallmarks of globalization and of global interactions, whether often quite dark and destructive and exploitative, which no doubt colonialism and imperialism was and still is. But there's a light and a dark sort of dimensions to such issues, and the sort of more light-hearted aspect of that is, yeah, the sorts of amusements and foods that are available at the seaside.
When Louis and Tom were creating the Coast of Teeth book, they brought an interesting technique to their research: psychogeography, a method that has a wealth of history behind it.
It was really developed as a means of countering urban planning to an extent, also countering commercial pathways, commercial kind of ventures that were happening in Paris particularly, and a way to subvert the walking in a sort of programmed way that kind of capitalism was engineering for people to kind of buy more things and go to markets, go to bazaars and so on and so forth, and really look at perhaps a more sort of fringe understanding of an urban space and literally a derive, which is sort of, you could almost imagine it as just arrive where you where you walk. So there's something also inherently surprising and serendipitous about the sort of methodology. And we very much took that on, not having any kind of preconceived ideas about the place, not even having any sort of, for me as an artist, some kind of preconceived sort of ideas of what I'm going to draw, but being sort of responsive to the things that we do and just putting a lot of wear and tear on our shoes and walking. I believe in Torquay, we clocked it. It was something around 14 miles we walked in a single day. Through a kind of rolling conversation, Tom stopping to write, me stopping to sort of draw, we ended up creating these sort of parallel texts, one in the imagery that I created through reportage drawing and the other in the writing that Tom was doing. But ultimately, it's quite an immersive experience. I always remember the quote, James Noctway, there's a fantastic documentary called War Photographer. And he said, the best possible scenario is for me to be a ghost, is to be there, but not really be seen, that you just, you're in and amongst, you're sort of absorbing the experience of the place without sort of leaving this kind of heavy footprint. That's very much the way I sort of approached it, and really being open to what are emblematic scenes, human dramas, small and large. And that's really what I was kind of responding to and thinking about how people act in these quite unique situations. This is not people just in the normal high street. They're on a beach or they're at an ice cream stand or something. These are things that are outside of the normal, regular experience.
A marine biologist will go to a seaside town, for example, and they'll be interested in the data that they will gather will be related to the diets or behaviors of sea life around. Yeah. A sociologist might go to a seaside town and be interested in demographics, poverty, or what percentage of the population are elderly, etc. What we do as psychogeographers, or whatever it is that you want to call us, we're trying to get an understanding of a space and its meaning to people.
So, we've heard the upsides and the downsides of the seaside town, certainly in the UK. What does Tom think the future holds for these places?
There are challenges ahead. I mean, we cannot stress one of the big themes of the book, and it speaks to a lot of other kind of work that Louis and I have done. We've both worked on projects based in the university, such as the Revolution Plastics Project. There's no denying that the environmental challenge is very real and growing unless we as a species start to pull ourselves together and do something about it. So there will be rising sea levels. There are other challenges, economic, social challenges of deprivation and poverty and the sort of alienation that we witness amongst young people especially. But again, I think the answer has to lie in solidarity and community responses where the state has possibly has arguably retreated from providing the sorts of services that are needed in seaside towns. People on the ground, people, as it were, below, have to sort of try and do what they can, work together, combine, and try to, you know, clean up their beaches. If someone else isn't going to do it, you sort of have to do it for yourself as a community. Or problems of deprivation. You know, Louis and I became optimists by the end of this because we saw a lot of the poverty and a lot of the kind of social problems facing seaside towns were being kind of combated by people making an effort with youth clubs and art projects and working together in sort of very constructive and creative ways to deal with these problems.
There are seaside towns who seem to have a very bright future, and there are other places which have substantial economic challenges. And with a continued lack of investment, with a continued lack of industry, jobs, and a sort of hopefulness for the population, those places will probably continue to suffer. And that's unfortunate. But of course, there is always hope. And there is always ways that these places could be reimagined with people that have the right kind of creativity and drive to do that.
Tom is sure that he and Louis won't be stopping exploring seaside towns or stopping at the British coastline either.
We'd like to do perhaps a Coast of Teeth Ireland, maybe doing Coast of Teeth USA. The methodology can be applied to other sorts of spaces and places. But what we hope we're doing that's relatively new and that gives us scope to take this further in a way that keeps us interested and more importantly, readers interested and viewers of Louis' illustrations, of course, is this sort of notion that actually, when you look at other contemporary psychogeographers, and I can give some people like Nick Papadimitriou and Will Self and Ian Sinclair, very good, very able sort of psychogeographic writers, they tend to be more interested in what we call inland England. In other words, cities, landlocked areas. It's the countryside. It's the what they call edgelands, which are these kind of contradictory areas between the countryside and the city. There isn't quite so much focus by other writers and other psychogeographers on the coastline. And that's where we think that there's real kind of value to be gained.
The seaside town is a British cultural institution, and its influence has spread to coasts around the world. But the challenges of the 21st century have left many communities struggling to keep their heads metaphorically above water. Handling deprivation, crime, and in a world of international air travel, the shift of holiday destinations. As is often the case, these towns live and die by the efforts put in by the local community. And as Tom and Louis have demonstrated, the history, diversity, and attraction of many of these towns deserve to be preserved. You can pick up a copy of Coast of Teeth in a number of bookshops and online. Thanks for listening to this episode of Life Solved. You are very welcome to be part of the discussion. Email us at lifesolved@port.ac.uk. That's lifesolved, one word, at port.ac.uk. Tell us what you think and make suggestions for future episodes of Life Solved. And we'd love it if you clicked follow on your podcast app so you never miss an edition. We'd really appreciate it if you left a rating or review as well. It helps us to get these conversations into more ears around the globe. If you've been inspired by this episode and you want to support our work, like Tom and Louis' writing and illustration, then head to port.ac.uk/lifesolved to find out how. You can also find out how to work or study with us. Next time, we move our focus from the sea to the sky, and specifically, UFOs.
If aliens exist, they definitely prefer America, because if you look at a distribution of where alien sightings are reported, it's almost all in the States.
Bye for now.